This is the 2011 West Coast School of the Prophets. Our theme for the weekend is The Day of the Lord Draweth Nigh. Our speaker is Brother Carl Perry from the Salisbury Ecclesia in Adelaide, Australia. This is session number 8, entitled Distress of Nations with Perplexities, Part 2. The reading was Luke chapter 21, verses 24 to 36. Brother Carl.
Okay, thanks Brother Tony, and welcome everybody. Well, we're going to look at what's called the Olivet Prophecy, and the reason why we're going to look at that is because there are predictions in this prophecy that affect our perception of prophecy, and there are events which are predicted which we see happening now. Now, we're going to spend a bit of time just putting the Olivet Prophecy into context so that we can understand precisely where we are in this particular prophecy. There are three records of the Olivet Prophecy. Matthew 24, Mark, do anyone know what the chapter in Mark is? 13, and Luke 21. And the secret of understanding the Olivet Prophecy is to put all three records together. So that this whole discourse with all three records gives us the full Olivet Prophecy. We ask the question, why did Matthew record this much and why did Mark record this much and why did Luke record this over here? And the reason is because the audiences were different. Okay? Matthew wrote to Jews, and therefore there's a very strong emphasis about what was happening to the Jewish people in this whole prophecy. Mark wrote to Romans, and therefore his concern was more in relation to Roman believers. And Luke wrote to the Gentile world. And therefore both Mark and Luke don't have the same emphasis about what was happening in Judea, because Matthew is the gospel for the Jews, if you like. I'm just going to choose Matthew 24 and Luke 21 for the parallel records to try and get contact points between the two prophecies that we can understand precisely what's going on here. Let's go to Matthew 24. The incident that sparked off the Olivet Prophecy was the Lord saying, this wonderful temple is going to be destroyed. And that took the disciples back quite a bit. They couldn't believe that this magnificent temple would be destroyed. How did Jesus know the temple would be destroyed? What prophecy predicts that? Daniel 8 and Daniel 9, exactly. So the Lord was fully aware that this would be destroyed. The disciples weren't. So in Matthew 24 and verse 3, as he sat upon the Mount of Olives, the disciples came unto him privately, saying, tell us, when shall these things be? What shall be the sign of thy coming and of the end of the world? Now the word world there is the Greek word aeon, end of the age. We're not talking about the planet being destroyed, we're talking about the end of an age. Greek word aeon, A-I-O-N. So those questions prompted what we know as the Olivet Prophecy. When shall these things be? When will the temple be destroyed? And what will be the sign of thy coming and the end of the age? Now, what is interesting is this word coming. When Jerusalem was overthrown by the Romans, there was a sense in which the presence of Jesus Christ was apparent. Not that he was literally visible, but there was a sense in which he was present superintending those particular armies. How do I know that? Let's come back to Daniel chapter 8. Now, in Daniel chapter 8, we have verses 9, 10, 11, and 12, the description of the growth of Rome and the destruction of the temple by the Romans. We looked a little bit about that very briefly yesterday. In verse 11, this power of Rome will magnify himself even against the prince of the host. And we said there, the prince of the host is Jesus Christ. And by him the daily sacrifice was taken away, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down. Now that little expression, cast down, was picked up in the Olivet prophecy. Matthew 24, these stones shall be thrown down. And the Lord used that expression, thrown down, because he pulled it out of Daniel chapter 8. The sanctuary was cast down. So you see, the Lord's mind is in this prophecy. Now, verse 12, an host, as an army, was given him. That is, an army was given the Romans against the daily sacrifice by reason of transgression. And it cast down the truth to the ground, it practiced and it prospered. So Daniel is saying that it's as though God was actually giving Rome the authority and the power of an army to fulfill this prophecy. Now we know that when Jesus Christ was raised from the dead and he ascended to the right hand of the Father, that all power and dominion was given to him. He took control of world affairs. So Jesus Christ is involved in this conflict. He is the one who gave the Roman armies the authority and military presence to actually fulfill this prophecy. He is involved in that. And in that sense, he came to superintend the destruction of Jerusalem. Couldn't visibly see him, but in the language of Matthew 24, let's come back to Matthew 24, it is called his coming. Now, from verses 4 through to verse 28 of Matthew 24, verses 4 to 28, we have the events described leading up to and including AD 70. So we could say from AD 30 to AD 70. By the way, it's highly likely that Christ was crucified in AD 30, not AD 33. That's another subject. Now, if we come to Matthew 24, why do we say that this is talking about the invasion of Jerusalem by Rome? Verse 26, wherefore if they shall say to you, behold, is in the desert, go not forth. Behold, is in a secret chamber, believe it not. For as the lightning cometh out of the east and shineth even unto the west, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be. For wheresoever the carcass is, there will the eagles be gathered. Now let's just absorb this language carefully. Question, is it literal or is it symbolic language? Verse 27, what do you reckon? Sorry?
Symbolic?
Symbolic? Okay, why do you say it's symbolic, Manny?
Because the Romans were covered in iron. So when they would come in, the sun would shine on them. So it looked like it was a flash of lightning coming towards them.
Okay, yeah, look, point taken. But let's just look at the language of verse 27 first. How do you know, just reading that verse 27, that it is symbolic? Because
he uses it as a picture, he says so also.
Yes, good, as an illustration, yes. Nathaniel. Yep.
To me, it seems when you lightning and from the east, like the east wind, that's representative of judgment.
Yeah, I think we're getting close, Neil.
I'm wondering how does lightning strike the east or west?
Exactly. If you've ever been in a lightning storm, it's everywhere, literally. In Australia it goes top to bottom, top to bottom. So Jesus is saying that this lightning is confined to the east. So naturally speaking, lightning is not confined shining out of the east. So immediately we're arrested, our attention is arrested, there's something unusual about this figure. Secondly, verse 28, literal or symbolic?
Symbolic.
So if verse 28 is symbolic, which is the explanation of verse 27, then we can conclude that verse 27 is also symbolic. And to me, because lightning is not confined to the east or the west, but it's everywhere, the Lord had something else in mind. Now, what's lightning a symbol of? Warfare. Proof? Can you have a quotation I'm thinking of? Where's a quote that depicts lightning as a symbol of warfare and judgment? Well, you've got your e-sword there, you've got your concordances. If you're not sure, can someone check it out? We want a good quote. So while someone's looking that up, we will press on. Now, what Jesus said was as lightning, so Chris is exactly right, it is a figure, a simile, as lightning, so shall the coming of the Son of Man be, for where the eagles are gathered. So all these three things are equated. They are explanations of each other. As, so, for. Where is the language of eagles and carcass from? Let's come to Deuteronomy 28. Okay? The Lord has his mind in Deuteronomy. I'll explain that in a moment. Deuteronomy 28. What verses? Where's the eagle? Verse 49. Yahweh shall bring a nation against thee as swift as the eagle flieth. So immediately the eagle becomes a symbol of a nation. That's the interpretation. A nation as an eagle flieth. Deuteronomy 28. And verse 49. And we know, as we discussed yesterday, that nation is Rome.
Verse 26 fits in that as well.
Verse 26. The carcass shall be meat to the fowls of the air. That's right, Israel's likened to a carcass. Verse 26, thank you. So, lightning, coming, Roman invasion are all paralleled in this verse. So the coming of the Son of Man was not a visible appearance of Jesus Christ. It was the providential supervision of the Roman invasion of Judea. Do we have that lightning quote yet?
Psalm 144.
Could you read that in verse 4, thanks, Leo?
Psalm 144, verse 6. Flash forth the lightning and scatter them. Send out your arrows and rout them. Stretch out your hand from on high. Rescue me and deliver me from many waters, from the hand of foreigners.
Okay. So what, Psalm 146 verse?
Sorry, that's 144 verse 6.
144 verse 6. Lightning is a symbol of God's judgment against the enemy, which causes them to scatter and flee. Psalm 144 verse 6. Okay, that's quite a good quote.
Psalm 14 says the same thing.
Same thing. Exactly. I thought it was one in Jeremiah or Ezekiel that had a similar kind of thing. But yes, lightning is a symbol of judgment, of armies, of force. Okay. So, coming back to Matthew 24. Here's the point. This is the reason why I'm saying the Lord's mind is in Deuteronomy 28. You see verse 56 of Deuteronomy 28. The tender and delicate woman among you, which would not have ventured to set the sole of her foot upon the ground for delicateness and tenderness, her eye shall be evil toward the husband of her bosom, and toward her son, and toward her daughter, and toward her young one that cometh out from between her feet, and toward her children which she shall bear. For she shall eat them for want of all things secretly in the siege and straitness wherewith thine enemy shall distress thee in the gates. So there's a particular prophecy that says that a woman would eat her infant child. Now come back to Matthew 24. Look at verse 19. But woe unto them that are with child, and to them that give suck in those days. Why did he mention that? Because he knew that Deuteronomy 28, there was a prediction that a woman would eat her child. So the Lord's mind is in Deuteronomy 28. Isn't that interesting? Woe unto them that are with child, because he knew that one or a number of those people would devour their own children. The Lord's mind is back in these Old Testament prophecies. Okay, let's come back to Matthew 24. We all agree then that verse 28 brings us to AD 70. Wherever the eagles are, the corpse is there too. Let's come across to Luke 21. And let's establish where we are in Luke 21. Well, look at verse 23 of Luke 21. But woe unto them that are with child. So we're in the same language, obviously, same context. We're talking about the siege of Jerusalem. Verse 24, they shall fall by the edge of the sword and shall be led away captive into all nations. So clearly, verse 24, part A, is up to AD 70. So that allows us to anchor Matthew 24 and Luke 21 in the record. We now know precisely where we are in the record. All right, everyone with me so far? Makes sense? Okay. Matthew 24 and Luke 21 all together make one big discourse. We just got to get ourselves exactly at the same synchronized point before we move on. Now, let's come back to Matthew 24. So, Matthew 24, verse 29 says this. Verse 29. Immediately after those days. So, what do you think verse 29 is going to refer to? Sorry? 87. Right. If verse 28 finishes with the eagles devouring the carcass, then verse 29, immediately after those days, means AD 70. AD 70 and a half. Immediately after the siege of Jerusalem. Okay? Everyone comfortable with that? Now, what'll happen? The sun shall be darkened. The moon, no light, and the stars shall fall from heaven. What do you think that refers to? Sorry?
Political powers in Israel.
Sun, moon, and stars is the eclipse of the Jewish government. Who does the sun represent? You have to speak up.
I'd say the president, whoever's running it.
The moon is the religious power. The sun, therefore, must be the civil power. There was a civil power. There were governors, people like the Herods of this world. Okay? So all of the civil government, the sun, the Herods of this world, gone. The religious power, Judaism, the chief rabbinate, the synagogue, the Sanhedrin, no power. And what about the stars? Who do the stars represent? People in authority, princes, businessmen, people who are stars. We even use the expression today. So AD 70, the whole government collapsed, darkened and withdrawn. Okay, sun, moon, and stars. So, we have now determined that in verse 29 is still AD 70. It goes on to say, the powers of the heaven shall be shaken. And that is an explanation of that verse there, isn't it? Of the phrase before. The powers of heaven is the sun, moon, and stars. Now, when we come to Luke 21... is there an equivalent verse dealing with that? Can you find somewhere in Luke 21, 24, 25, 26, anything about the eclipse of sun, moon, and stars? No. Answer is no. So that means that we will continue on in Matthew 24, okay? So Matthew 24 is going to give us some more information. Now, verse 30 is where it gets interesting. Are everyone happy with that? The eclipse of the Jewish state immediately after the Romans desecrated the place. Sun, moon, and stars out. Chris?
So even though verse 25 in Luke 21 says, and there will be signs in the sun, moon, and stars,
yes.
It's not the same.
No. We're talking about the eclipse, the darkening, okay? But we will come to that verse in a moment. Are everyone happy with verse 29? Okay, let's come to verse 30. Verse 30. Matthew 24, verse 30. And then shall appear, so we have a word then, which is not definite, shall appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven. Okay, now we've got to get this absolutely clear in our mind. What does this mean? Firstly, when you read the word then, the immediate connotation you have in your mind is, well, this has just come after the previous verse, so the Jewish world's been eclipsed, removed, then the next event. But that's not necessarily true. This is a bit of an indeterminate word, okay? We need Luke 21 to help us here in a moment. Firstly, whatever this event is, it happens in heaven. From the language that we have just read in verse 29, what do you think that word heaven refers to?
Politics.
So it's not literal. It is symbolic. And it comes on the heels of verse 29, where we have seen the powers of heaven shall be shaken. And therefore, most likely, it has a reference to which heaven? What was the heaven of verse 29? Jewish heaven. So it is highly likely, and we'll confirm this in a moment, it is a sign in the Jewish heaven. Because that's the immediate context of the verse before. Now, here's the next tricky part. This expression here, the sign of the Son of Man, we need to understand. That is not saying the Son of Man will appear. What's it saying? A sign will appear. This expression, the sign of the Son of Man, is simply the Son of Man's sign. The sign belongs to him. The sign is given by him. The sign is not of Jesus Christ. It's a sign which is given by him. If I say the apple of John, it's John's apple. It's a possessive. The sign of the Son of Man is the Son of Man's sign. The sign isn't the Son of Man. It belongs to the Son of Man. There's a distinction. All right, any questions or comments on that? Ah, okay, we'll come to that. But firstly, does that make sense? So whatever happens after AD 70, and we don't know yet because we need another record to give us the time frame, there will appear in the Jewish heavens, in the political arena, a sign. And this sign is the Son of Man's sign. It's his personal sign that he's given in the heavens. Let's go to Luke 21. Does Luke supply extra information? And the answer is yes. And he gives us a clue as to how to understand what this sign is. Is there anything about the word sign in Luke 21, 24, 25? Is there anything in that? Chris says there is. In verse 25, we have... What does the verse say? There shall be signs where? Sun, moon, and stars. That's the heavens. So what are we saying? We are saying that Luke 21 verse 25 is a verse that begins to explain Matthew 24 verse 30. The sign in heaven of Matthew 24 verse 30 is amplified in Luke 21 verse 25. It's a sign in the sun, moon and stars. But hold on, we've missed out verse 24b. What does verse 24b say? Until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled. So this missing part here, Jerusalem trodden down until the times of the Gentiles fulfilled, can be reinserted back into Matthew 24 under the word then. Wow, this is a leap of logic, isn't it? What are we saying? We dovetail all the records together, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and in dovetailing them together, we find contact points where each of the record mentions the same event. And we find, in fact, that there are gaps in the Mark record, there's gaps in the Matthew record, there's gaps in the Luke record. It's not just Matthew and Luke, it's there. And you've got to piece them all together to get this sequential thing. Now, we have agreed that verse 24a of Luke 21 brings us to AD 70. We have agreed in verse 28 that we're down at AD 70. So we found a synchronized part of the speech. We then discover that Matthew adds this additional information. Then shall appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven. Luke also talks about this, but he says this sign in heaven actually is specifically sun, moon and stars. But it's the 24b that supplies the key into the time frame of the record. Luke 21:24b says that, well, hold on, there's a 2,000-year gap here because we have Jerusalem trodden down until the times the Gentiles are fulfilled, and then comes the sign. Now, we saw that Christ's mind was not only in Deuteronomy 28, it was also in Joel chapter 3. Anyone remember the word link in Joel 3? The word captivity. In those days, at that time, when I reverse again the captivity of Judah and Jerusalem. Jesus used that word. Luke 21:24a, they shall go into captivity. Joel chapter 3, we saw a little while ago that when Russia invades Israel, the language of Joel is the darkening of the sun, the darkening of the moon, and the darkening of the stars. The clear implication is that the sun, moon, and stars are shining before Russia takes Israel. And that's why the Lord Jesus Christ could use sun, moon, and stars to describe the coming again of the Jewish people. So Matthew 24 has them collapsing and eclipsing. Luke 21 has them reigniting and alive once more. So the sign in heaven is the sign of the sun, moon and stars. It's Jewish sun, Jewish moon, Jewish stars, Jewish heaven. And it dovetails just like that. Same message, slightly different language. Now the wonderful thing about the Jewish state is that in 1948, not only did the parliament come back, the sun, but the Jews decided to actually bring the chief rabbinate back and reintroduce Judaism as the established religion of the state. The moon's back as well. And if you examine the basic doctrines of Judaism in the chief rabbinate, you'll find it's very similar to first century Judaism, should I say. And the stars, well, we've got the diplomats, haven't we? So what Luke 21:25 is saying is that the sign, the personal sign given by Jesus Christ, his personal sign, is the re-establishment of the state of Israel in the Jewish heavens. All right, any questions or comments?
So then the times of the Gentiles, is the times of the Gentiles occupying Jerusalem? Is that, or is it the times of the Gentiles' opportunity?
Throw it back to the group. Jerusalem shall be trodden down, times of Gentiles shall be fulfilled, and then Jerusalem will be freed. So is that expression times the Gentiles, the times of Gentile occupation of Jerusalem, or is it the times of the Gentiles generally, which goes beyond Armageddon? What do you think? Okay, not sure. I think it's the times of the Gentiles in relation to the occupation of Jerusalem. They've had their time. There's an expression actually used in Daniel, the times, and I think it's drawn from there. Okay, let's come back to Luke 21, and we read at the end of verse 25, distress of nations with perplexity. So whilst the sun, moon, and stars of Israel are reignited, shining in full brightness, the earth is distressed. So how would you define the earth in that verse? Everything non-Jewish. Everything non-Jewish. If the sun, moon, and stars in the heaven are all Jewish, then the earth must be everything that's non-Jewish. The common people, the common nations. And we find it's distress of nations with perplexity. And what I find interesting with that particular verse is that since 1967, the linkage of international issues compounded by travel, internet, communication, instantness of the whole world, that a problem in one country immediately becomes a problem in another. For example, the USA very kindly gave us the mortgage problem, which brought down the world financial crisis. Thanks, guys. Everything is interwoven. It's distress of nations with perplexity. The nations define the earth. And that's why internationally there is no solution. Because it's distress. The word perplexity, anyone know what the word perplexity means? No way out. No way out. And that's true. I mean, where are the solutions? No way out. Doesn't matter which way they go, the solution doesn't solve the problem, and the problem gets worse and worse and worse. So on the earth, distress of nations with perplexity. Not that Israel's not involved in all of that, but certainly amongst the nations it happens. The sea and the waves roaring. Sea and waves represent
nations.
Isaiah 57 verse 20, the wicked are like the troubled sea, casting up mire and dirt. It's Isaiah 57, 20. So we have this huge global distressing situation at the same time in which the Jewish state is back. We will continue to see distress of nations. Everything's topsy-turvy. Seasons are out of kilter. Natural disasters are getting worse and worse. Hurricanes, typhoons, cyclones, whatever you want to call them, are getting worse and worse. Everything's getting worse and worse. Everything is not right with the world. And that will continue to cycle perplexity. Verse 26, men's hearts failing them for fear and for looking after those things which are coming on the earth. Now that expression at the end of verse 26, for the powers of heaven shall be shaken, we came across that expression in our reading today. Whereabouts in Joel 3 is that expression from? Who can find it? Let's turn it up. Somewhere in Joel 3, the powers of heaven shall be shaken. Could you read it out for us, please?
The Lord also will roar from Zion and utter his voice from Jerusalem. The heavens and earth will shake. The Lord will be a shelter for his people and the children, and the strength of the children of Israel.
The Lord is quoting from Joel chapter 3, verse 16, did you say?
Yes.
What does that verse describe? Armageddon. So the powers of heaven being shaken at the end of verse 26 is Armageddon, and therefore the next verse in Luke 21, and then shall they see the Son of Man coming, makes absolute chronological sense. And that's why there's distress, because in the end all of these world problems get worse and worse and worse and worse, and all of a sudden there's a huge massive invasion of the Middle East, the powers of heaven are shaken, and then Christ comes. That's perfectly chronological in its order. Any questions on that? The powers of heaven being shaken is the power of the Jewish heavens being shaken, and that's when there's distress upon the earth. As Daniel says, it's a time of trouble such as never was. Daniel 12, verse 1. Any questions? Neil?
Having considered that the signs basically telling us that the powers of Israel would be restored again,
yep.
What were the brethren thinking 100 years ago about this prophecy? Terms of
I honestly wasn't there 100 years ago. I may look old, but not that old.
But I mean, my point is they believed Christ was coming in their day. I know they studied the same prophecies as we. So
well, it's like Brother Thomas. Brother Thomas writing 1840s, he sees Russia attack Turkey. He sees a promise there. The brethren and sisters living in 1948 saw the Jewish return, the Jewish state. Those in 67 saw the grabbing of Jerusalem. Every generation sees the signs in relation to their own environment, and therefore look for that kind of thing. That's the way the brotherhood's gone. Every generation's had these little spurts of biblical activity to encourage it to think that Christ is coming. Every generation's expecting it. We are too. We just think the signs are greater and stronger. Yep. Jason, you had a question?
I was just going to add, if you look at last days of Jewish commonwealth and ways of providence, both Brother Robert and Brother Thomas have the exact same idea, just not as detailed.
Yep. Yeah. Okay, so we've worked our way through Luke 21, okay? Now we've got to go back to Matthew 24 and try and make the connections as well, okay? Let's come back to Matthew 24. Okay, so we've got to Matthew 24, and we've got to verse 30, then shall appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven, and we've seen that Luke 21 interprets that to be the Jewish heavens and earth coming back. And then it says, and then shall all the tribes of the earth mourn, and they shall see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. So Matthew is giving us another bit of information after the sign of the Son of Man in heaven. When do the tribes of the earth mourn? When do the tribes of the earth see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven with power? Yeah, these tribes are the tribes of Israel. The word earth can refer to land. When do the tribes of Israel mourn? And the answer is Zechariah chapter 12. Let's turn to that, shall we? Zechariah 12. Which verse did you have in mind, Nathaniel? Verse 9. Let's start with verse 9. Let's start with this, shall we? Okay, let's read from verse 9 to verse 14, and we'll start with Chris going a verse each through Phil that way through there. Okay, Zechariah 12, verse 9 to 14. One verse each.
And it shall come to pass that day that I will seek to destroy all the nations that come against Jerusalem. And I will pour upon the house of David and upon the inhabitants of Jerusalem the spirit of grace and the supplications. And they shall look upon me when they have pierced, and they shall mourn for him, as one mourneth for his only son, and shall be in bitterness for him, as one that is in bitterness for his firstborn.
In that day shall there be a great mourning in Jerusalem, as the mourning of Hadadrimmon in the valley of Megiddo.
The land shall mourn, every family by itself, the family of the house of David by itself, and their wives by themselves. The family of the house of Nathan by itself, and their wives by themselves.
The family of the house of Levi by itself, and their wives by themselves. The family of Shimei by itself, and their wives by themselves.
All the families that remain, every family apart, and their wives apart.
Jesus used the expression tribes of the earth, or the tribes of the land. So verse 12 says, the land shall mourn every family apart. And there are two tribes mentioned, the tribe of Judah and the tribe of Levi. But in verse 14, all families that remain, will also mourn. So the tribes of the land was a little allusion to Zechariah 12 here. Now, what has Matthew done? Matthew has, in fact, missed Armageddon. He's gone straight into Zechariah 12 with the mourning of the Jewish tribes and the return of Jesus Christ to Israel. Not that he forgot Armageddon, it's just that Armageddon's in Luke 21. And that's why you've got to bring Luke 21 and Matthew 24 together to get the full story. And that's the secret of understanding the ultimate prophecy. So Matthew is also exactly chronological. Let's come back to Matthew 24. In Matthew 24, what's he got? In Matthew 24 and verse 30, he's got the sign of the Jewish heavens back. He's got the tribes of Israel mourning when they see the Son of Man coming. And then in verse 31, he shall send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet, and they shall gather together his elect from the four winds from one end of earth to the other. Now, let's look at verse 31. Is this the angels gathering the saints, or is it something else? Well, we need to look at the prophetic language that the Lord is using. The word angels, by the way, can refer to messengers, mortal or immortal. Doesn't necessarily have to be the immortal type. Now, a great sound of a trumpet. Is there anywhere in the Old Testament where the great sound of the trumpet draws people back? Yeah, the shofar. But I'm thinking of a specific passage. Let's come to Isaiah 27. Isaiah 27. Which verse do you have in mind, Jason?
13.
Let's read verse 12 to 13, shall we? You can read that for us, please. Isaiah 27, 12 to 13.
And it shall come to pass in that day that the Lord shall beat off from the channel of the river under the stream of Egypt, and you shall be gathered one by one, O ye children of Israel. And it shall come to pass in that day that the great trumpet shall be blown, and they shall come which are ready to perish in the land of Assyria, and the outcasts in the land of Egypt, and shall worship the Lord in the holy mountain.
What an amazing quote. Here is the restitution of the Jewish people, and the Jubilee trumpet is blast across the earth and all the tribes come back. That's the picture of Isaiah 27. That's exactly what Jesus is talking about. He's not talking about the angels going out bringing the saints to judgment. He's talking about the messengers of God going out to bring the Jewish people back. Now, can we confirm that? Yes, we can. See, back in Matthew 24... Jesus used a particular phrase. Matthew 24. They shall gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. Let's come to the book of Deuteronomy. Because the book of Deuteronomy, that expression is used in the context of the regathering of Israel. Deuteronomy 29. How about that? We've gone from Deuteronomy 28 to Deuteronomy 29, and we come into Deuteronomy 30. And we read from verses 1 to 4 this language. Okay, starting from you, Nathan, verse each, please. Deuteronomy 30, verses, let's read 1 to 5. Deuteronomy 30, verses 1 to 5.
Okay, I apologize. Then the Lord your God will restore your fortunes and have compassion on you, and he will gather you again from all the peoples where the Lord your God has scattered you.
If any of thine be driven out unto the outmost parts of heaven, from thence will the Lord thy God gather thee, and from thence will he fetch thee.
The Lord thy God will bring thee into the land which thy fathers possessed, and thou shalt possess it. And he will do thee good and multiply thee above thy fathers.
Okay. Now there are two links to the Olivet prophecy in this section. Unfortunately, I think Levi, your translation obscured one of them. Verse 3, Yahweh will turn thy captivity. I think you had fortunes in your translation.
Yeah, restore your fortunes.
But turn thy captivity. There's that word captivity again. The Jews will go into captivity. That's why the Lord's mind is in quotations that talk about the reversal of that captivity. And here's the other one. In verse 4, if any of thine be driven out unto the utmost parts of heaven, and that's Matthew 24, let's come back to Matthew 24, the utmost parts of heaven. Now you don't see Jews floating in the sky. Hopefully not. The uttermost parts of heaven. So back in Matthew 24, and verse 31, he shall gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. He had his mind in Deuteronomy 30 after he had his mind in Deuteronomy 28. So that's exactly sequential. After Jesus reveals himself to the tribes and they mourn, we've got the rest of the Jewish people to bring back to the land. That's what Matthew talks about. Jimmy.
Another support for that, as far as that phrase or that term, his elect. Isaiah 45 verse 4 says, for Jacob my servant's sake and Israel my elect.
Good.
Israel link.
Thank you. Excellent quote. Could you, next to the word elect in Matthew 24, you might want to put Isaiah 45 verse
4.
Okay, good. I'll put that in my margin as well. I haven't got that. Good. Israel, mine elect. Isaiah 45, verse 4. Okay.
I have 65:15 as well.
Jason.
Can I add one to
you? You may, please.
Zechariah chapter 2, verses 6 and 7.
Yep.
It says, ho, ho, come forth and flee from the land of the north, saith the Lord, for I have spread you abroad as the four winds of heaven.
So good. Excellent quote. So next to four winds in Matthew 24, could you want to write in Zechariah 2, verses 6 to 7. That is the calling of the Jewish people from the four winds back to the land. So you see, all the language is prophetic. All the language is restoration of the Jewish people. It's all chronological. At that point in the discourse, the Lord really finishes and he adds some exhortations. Parable about the fig tree, some exhortations about watching. And what you find is that Matthew's exhortations about the servant in the house and the wise virgins and the man who had the talent are all relevant to a Jewish audience. Whilst to Luke, it's relevant to a Gentile audience. So let's come back to Luke 21. And this really is the exhortation that we'll leave you with, and then we'll have a break. Luke 21, verse 34. Take heed to yourselves, lest at any time your hearts be overcharged with surfeiting and drunkenness and cares of this life, and that day come upon you unawares. For as a snare should it come on all them that dwell on the face of the earth, the whole earth. Watch ye therefore and pray always that you may be accounted worthy to escape all these things that shall come to pass and to stand before the Son of Man. Now this is the exhortation for our times. How did Jesus know that the latter days, just before he returned, would be characterized by overcharging? That really is a headache after debauchery. That's the idea of the Greek word. And drunkenness and the cares of this life. How did he know that? Well, obviously, through prophetic inspiration. But that's our age exactly. Cares of this life, carelessness, drunkenness, partying, carrying on. That's the age of the Gentiles. Watch lest at any time your hearts, so it's a thing of the heart. If your heart's not solid with God, it's going to be elsewhere. It can affect the heart. Watch ye therefore and pray always. So the antidote all of those problems is to watch and pray. That's the antidote. That Jesus Christ is giving us the solution to surviving the age. Watch and pray. We're going to be watchmen. Not just signs of the times, but our own life, our families, our ecclesias, our youth groups, young people's activities. We're going to be watchmen, alert. Now, Tony and I were talking a little while back before the School of the Prophets, saying, well, you know, as far as current events are concerned, there is so much going on. How can we possibly watch? There's just, you know, we're bombarded by information, newspapers, documentaries, video, TV, you name it, all over the place. Is there any way that we can take a shortcut here to stop ourselves trawling the internet and wasting time and time and time looking at newspapers and articles to try and see how these things are fitting the prophetic word? Is there a shortcut that's going to give us the information without us having to spend hours and hours and hours getting this? And the answer is yes, there is. Now, I subscribe to a newsletter by Brother Don Pierce. Don Pierce wrote Milestones. Do you get milestones every year? If not, you should get milestones. Fantastic publication. Once a year, summarizing current events in relation to Bible prophecy. He sends out 4 emails roughly a week which summarize key world affairs in relation to prophecy. And I found, I skim through half and read the other half, I find that, those 4 emails saves me enormous amount of time trawling the internet, reading papers, getting information. It gives me exactly what I want without me having to actually spend time doing that. And I would suggest to you, I would recommend to you, get hold of that newsletter. Now the email address, we'll get later. I think it's milestones.org, I think. We'll get that to you later. But that is an ideal way of was
it? We're all like ready to
Yeah, that's exactly, that's right, yeah. Sorry, you're ready to go, and I forgot it. We'll get that to you, because honestly, it is a huge plus. He does all the hard work, he does all the trawling, and he summarizes exactly what you want. It is magnificent. So we'll get that to you. But that's the way we can watch without actually getting involved in the cares of this life and wasting time. So I'm going to, you got it, have you, sorry?
Yeah, milestonesuk at aol.com. Milestones, plural, UK, at AOL.com.
No
spaces? No
spaces. He uses AOL. Talk about Gmail.
Okay. And I'm sure he'll be pleased to get a heap of emails saying, who are you guys? You know.
What's the brother name?
Sorry?
When we email, what should we grab?
Dear Brother Don. Brother Carl Parry said that you have a terrific email. Could you please send me some emails? Now, you want to subscribe to his newsletter, and he'd be more than happy to add you to the email list. Okay?
He also doesn't add you to the email list. So just ask to be added to his list.
Yeah, just ask to be added to the email list.
Send your email address on there, and send it.
Well worth it. So, look, I want to leave this session with you in prophecy to say that be aware of what's happening and be thrilled with what's happening, because it's coming exactly as we expected in relation to the things of prophecy. But more importantly, as we conclude this series, watch and pray always that we may be counted worthy to escape all these things and to stand before the Son of Man. So let's take a 15-minute break, and then we'll come and continue on with the life of Moses. Okay, thank you.